This is Comer Shenanigans, episode 1038, Book of the Month Club, Spider-Man, Web of Life, Web of Death.
Saga continues. Peter is finally starting to put the spider behind him as he hits the jackpot, only to be stunned by a plot that wants him to be superior. Ben is drawn to his responsibility like a moth to a flame, with a hatred for a scarlet moniker. But we start to see some confidence and less self-loathing. All the while, Hayne has begun to step out of the shadows with his own agenda, with an origin still shrouded in mystery. Also, questionable memories begin to flash in the minds of our heroes. What could they mean? Comic Shenanigans is proud to present our next chapter of the Spider-Man Clone Saga.
Thank you so much, Paul Scores. This is Comic Shenanigans, episode 1038, Book of the Month Club, Spider-Man, Web of Life, Web of Death. I'm your host, Adam Chapman, joined as always by Paul Scores, whose dulcet tones you just heard, and also by Nathan Strzok. Nathan, say hello.
Hello.
So today we're talking about the next 2 months of the Spider-Man Clone Saga. We're talking about the Web of Life and the Web of Death, which concurrently happened between the four Spider-Man books. We're also talking about the funeral for an octopus, as well as Spider-Man Unlimited, I believe, issue 8. So this is kind of the next step. We get to see more of the expansion of what we saw in the last chapters, which was Back from the Edge and the Exile Returns, as the Clone Saga continues, not towards any upcoming end, because it's got years to go, but at the time they still thought maybe at this point that it might be ending soon. Nate, you and I off podcast have mentioned that, you know, as these storylines start unfolding, it starts to feel more padded, and a little bit more like we have these four-part storylines that maybe could have been two-part. We kind of saw that with Back from the Edge, although that was more, I think, evident with the Ben Reilly stuff than it was with the Spider-Man stuff, which at least got two separate stories within. Now we have Web of Life. Let's talk about that first. We have more adventures with Scarlet Spider. We get to see the Grim Hunter, who has been offered up by Howard Mackey as a villain that Kane can off as after having only just been introduced in Spider-Man 50. So what were your thoughts reading the Web of Life again, Nate?
So we're starting with
Web of Spider-Man. Actually, you know what I realized? Sorry. Before I actually ask you about it, let's do one more thing. I've been really enjoying looking at what's been happening in comics at the same time as the stuff that we're reading. So this time I want to take a quick mention to tell you that in the month that Web of Death Part 1 came out, which would have been November 1994, the the most issues sold of comics that month was X-Men number 40, which was the Part 2 of Legion Quest. As we're leading into Age of Apocalypse is about to start. And then rounding out the rest of the top 10 included Spawn, number 26, Uncanny X-Men 320, Generation X, number 3, Rogue, number 1, by Michael Ringo, and I forgot who wrote it now, Wolverine, 89, so almost at that big episode, big issue 90. We got Wetworks, number 2, Wildcats, number 15, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, number 1, and Bishop, number 2. Those are the top 10. Spider-Man didn't even crack the top 20.
It's Howard Mackey.
It was Howard Mackey? Oh, that makes sense. So that those are the top books that were coming out. In terms of what was happening on the TV screen at that point, November 1994 saw the Dark Phoenix saga in its entirety on the X-Men animated series come out. And in the Spider-Man world, we've got the first episode of its animated series, Night of the Lizard. And those were happening kind of sporadically, but Iron Man and FF both had episodes 7 to 13 come out in November, December that year. And then one last thing, just because it was so bizarre, I had to look it up. I don't know why it came to my head. Do you know, in 1994, what McDonald's slogan was?
This is before I'm Loving It, right? I'm Loving It was a big shift.
That was a big shift, yeah. And that wasn't until 2003.
I remember the excitement around found McDonald's pizza. What was that, like 91, 92?
I think
and
so.
And I don't remember it. No, I don't. I'm brainwashed by the
Bada Bada. I'm loving it.
That's all I have right now. Yeah, they've done a good job rebranding. I don't know. What is it?
So it was from 92 to 95. It is what you want is what you get.
Okay. I do remember that. It's not great, but I do remember that.
There was also fun little promotion, which was what you want is what you get at Rock Donald's today. Because Flintstone promotion.
Better than a lesser known slogan that may have been like kiboshed early on, which is "What you're going to get what we want to give you." Like that was a little more aggressive, I think, you know? If you want ice cream and it's after 11:30, our machine mysteriously breaks every single night. That's also a good thing.
They also
now, obviously like Power Rangers is fairly peak popularity at this point, but who published that issue one at the time?
Hamilton.
I don't know.
Never heard of them.
Okay. Yeah, it was probably a hot garbage book. I don't think they did any justice to it.
I would imagine not. Like, yeah, I've never heard of Hamilton before as a publisher, but as I said, Spider-Man didn't even crack the top 20. I think Amazing Spider-Man 397 was number 21 on the list. Still ahead of Detective Comics and Action Comics, but, not doing so well because, people wanted their image books.
Right.
You had Pitt was number 11. Anyways, so now we can actually talk about real comics. I do enjoy looking at what was popular at the time.
Yeah, that's good. I like this. This is a good thing. An intro to each show. I like it.
It's contextualization. You know where we are, where comics are, where Marvel is. I mean, they're about to enter the Age of Apocalypse, which is super important for the Clone Saga because of that success. They're like, well, you got to do something like this. That's why you have the Scarlet Spider books where, Spider-Man leaves, gives Ben Reilly the costume and says, you can be the guy now. And then you get 2 months of random Scarlet Spider books that have no real connection because they couldn't make him Spider-Man yet because marketing said, you got to be just like the Age of Apocalypse. So the Age of Apocalypse definitely has a long shadow, which continues to today because obviously it's one of the, those big things that people really remember. Paul, you wouldn't have heard this, but on a recent episode, I interviewed Ariana Mara, who is a letterer with Virtual Calligraphy that does a lot of Marvel books. And she was saying that for her, Age of Apocalypse was her Star Wars. It was that big, like, huge thing. She's the same age as I am, and it was so big and impactful. So anyways, those are our context information for this episode. Nate, talk about Web of Life.
I'm going to call it Chapman's Context Corner.
Ooh, I love it.
Not perfect alliteration, but it's not. I know you like a good alliteration. I guess I'll just, as an overview first, and then maybe we'll go and pick around the specific issues. Is that what you want to do? So, Web of Spider-Man 120, and then Spider-Man, what is it, 54? The first two chapters here, I dig these. I think they're nice. I think they're solid. I really like the Betty Brant stuff that happens with Ben and Betty. Really, kind of sexy, salacious, really kind of hot and heavy meetings, for like a sexier version of in the Superman original movie, the Dick Donner movie, where she comes to visit him to be a journalist, to do a story on him. I guess he comes to visit her. It's her apartment. And so it's the same kind of thing, right? Like Ben swoops down while Betty is, I guess, writing a story outside. And so I really enjoy those parts. The arts I really like. I think that Stephen Butler is doing fantastic work, especially in 120. Fantastic fight with him and Tombstone. Really showing up the Ben Reilly mask. I still prefer Tom Lyle in his rendition, obviously, because he's like the creator of that costume. But there's just something about this non-costume. We talked about it last time, how the challenge was to create a costume that's not a costume. And the arachnid eyes, Peter always kind of had, especially with Ditko, right? Starting out with Ditko, the eyes are just larger than human eyes and they're a little bit intense. And those obviously get fan out, get wider with, McFarlane, and then Bagley does almost half of the head has these big, wide eyes. But the angularity of the design here just makes him look like an alien, right? It's almost insectoid. It's not insectoid, but it's unnerving. And so I really like, especially like later on with Betty, her trying to kind of like see the man's face behind it. I just think in terms of themes of I'm not a man, I'm not a person, which Ben keeps repeating in his internal monologue or narration here, it works. It's just something, you know, it's a cool 90s effect, the torn sleeves and everything in the pouches, but it's just something about this, these eyes. Butler does a great job with them as well. So I think that setting up the story here is really good. It's a web of life. Ben's finding a new life for himself. Kane is introduced. He's overly mysterious. His costume I still love, even though it's quite horrible. It doesn't make any sense. His face is a mask, but the mask kind of... I don't understand this mask. It defies all physics. Like, you can see every detail in his face, but then when he's talking, you can, like, see his... Like, his mouth... You know what I mean? Like, it goes mm-hmm. into his mouth. Like, he'll open his mouth, and then it looks like there's still a mask. You never see... Okay, but it's... It's not like covering his face like Peter's does. It's inside, and then his eyes can see, but there's no eye holes. But it is very, you know, to its credit, it kind of has this almost gothic look to it, kind of Frankensteinian, gross veins, spikes kind of coming off of him. So there, the monster aesthetic is there. I don't know. And the grunge haircut, I just love it. Although for all these stories, Kane is just in the background, either snapping necks or he's following people around, having visions and being in agony. So they don't really know, I guess, what they're doing with him yet, but, you know, it is what it is. One of my favorite drawings of Ben is in this issue, standing with his mask off with a gargoyle. I don't know which page this is, but I'm showing the boys. If I could get a page of Ben original art, this would probably be an amazing one to have. I think that the first two chapters work well. They set up the Grim Hunt, the new Grim Hunt, as it were. They kind of establish the players. And there's a little bit of storyline about Ben getting his life together and developing new relationships, going back in time, visiting the Bugle, meeting JJJ again, having a little altercation there. Everyone's kind of, you know, Mary Jane returns. Their motivations are established. The art's really nice. Ben popping down. I love all the work they're doing in this era of Ben on a thread, either upside down or just kind of hanging impossibly under a tree. And then the second two chapters hit, and it's just people running around the city trying to find each other for like two entire books, and Kane beating up people and snapping more necks, and it just, and the toy, it's the toys smashing into each other, right? It's the maximum carnage effect where they're like, well, we have two more chapters. I don't know what to do. I feel like I'm going on too much. But I will say before I pause, once we get to Spider-Man 55, guest artist Mike Manley comes in. Mm-hmm. I don't know who Mike Manley is, but I love everything he's doing here. I looked for pages by him after I read this, couldn't find it or any of them to buy, but I really love the art there. So, yeah, you're right, Adam. They could have cut the last two books out, just kind of made it more streamlined, and it would have been more enjoyable. I'm
going to
stop now.
I will say about Spider-Man 55. So, as you said, you have Mike Manley, you have Joe Rubenstein on inks, who has actually just been in my last episode. I interviewed him, so I did not ask him about this particular issue. Maybe I should have. It's interesting because, you know, it does feel like an issue where maybe Mike Manley had some pages longer than others to really put his work into. Because, like, that first page... I mean, it's an ass shot, but I mean, it's a good one. Like, it definitely gets the image across of Ben just being spent and just kind of slumped over in the snow, which is a hard thing to do and to capture that kind of feeling. You can almost feel the snow. So there's just something really nice about that. And so the first couple pages are really good. And then you get into the Grim Hunter fighting Kane, and it feels like it's really loose. Not a lot of detail in the faces. They start to get really abstract. And so you kind of start to lose the thread because it was so strong in the first little bit, and then you start to lose the details. So I'm curious, you know, what kind of deadlines were you under? Because both this issue and part three are by guest artists. Was this, you know, what was happening with the shipping schedule at this point? Was it because they're doing this interarching storyline and, you know, they didn't have the issues fast enough? Like, what happened that caused them to need guest artists on both? So I'm always curious about stuff like that. What I do feel about Kane, I love that image as well, that, you know, his costume, but it couldn't, I don't think his image his rendition could feel any more 90s if you tried. Like, just everything about the costume and the grungy hair, like, it just, he feels so of the time period. And plus the fact that he's all shrouded in mystery, again, feels like an X-Men character. Like, an X-Men character at the time was all mystery, you know, all sizzle, no steak. Now, from what I've read from Glenn Greenberg's side, they knew that Kane from the beginning was going to be a defective clone. Like, that apparently, like, it was shrouded in secrecy outside the office, so only the Spider office knew it, but they did know. So, and you can start to see it here, like, when you actually know who he's going to be, all the pieces fit. But at the time, it wouldn't, people wouldn't have known to look for that.
Yeah, no, you're right. There's narration that they put in there. I forget the issue right now, but he's talking, he's looking at Peter, so it must have been like Web of Death, and he's talking about, you were born to this destiny, and I was born for another. And you're like, okay, so the idea that he's talking constantly about, like, his relationship to spiders, oh, it's right here. So it's Web of Death, Amazing 397, page 2. It's just like first panel. No regrets, of course. I am what I am, what I was meant to be, while you were born to a far different destiny. Like, there's a lot of that motif that keeps coming up in his narration about his relationship to the spiders. And then almost immediately after that, you get to the next page and Peter's starting to have these flashbacks of being born or cloned, right, in this container. So they're dancing around it. I don't know what I was thinking is, like, they don't seem to know what to do with it. Like, certainly I can buy they have an identity, they have an understanding of his background, but he's just standing around in the rain. We were joking before we recorded that Doc Ock's doing a lot of voyeurism in this. But the voyeur extraordinaire of these two arcs is just, you know, Kane looking at everybody. And then if he's not looking at you in your window or above you, he's having flash forwards of your death. Like, he's looking in on you through time or in space. Like, you can't not be looked at by Kane. It's the kind of the weird thing here. So they don't seem to know what to do with him in an interesting way, right? He's just looking at things and breaking necks.
Yeah, that's fair.
Or touching people with the mark of Kane, right? That's his big thing. Like, I guess, you know, the initial, like, you know, again, not knowing what we know now, right? If you're reading at the time, you think his power set is based on he's like this walking virus almost, right? Like, he can touch you and contaminate you and he's going to kill you, right? Because he kills a Grim Hunter, he kills Dr. Octopus. Like, he's doing all these things and you see all the vain stuff succumb his victims, right? So it's very interesting that, you know, yeah, we can kind of find ways to connect the dots post-mortem, but at the time, they do a really good job, you know, making you not put the pieces together too easily that he is, in fact, this failed clone that we find out much later as we move on in the stories.
There really is so much to build on him. Like, the fact that, like, even Peter and Ben have these eye shapes that I was talking about before, and they can give them personality, and they can squint, and they can kind of make the eye shapes change impossibly, which they've really done a great job with Spider-Verse movies, showing how the unmoving masks change based on expression. And then, you know, obviously they've done, like, the Tony Stark-esque kind of, like, well, they actually have irises in the movies, and the you know, Tom Holland films and stuff, so they're playing around with that. Again, even Ditko did this. But Kane never gets eyes, right? Like, Kane, they all have face coverings, all these clones, but Kane never even gets a face, right? And, like, I know we'll get to this later when we talk more about his powers get explained eventually, but how they explain his spider sense has gone wrong. How they explain what the mark of Kane is with his ability to stick to things. He doesn't stick to things in the same way. Like, it's really a lot of really cool building blocks there. Great stuff that they build on and add to later on. I really like this character, and I'm kind of, like, inspired from rereading these to just go and collect or read, at least on Marvel Unlimited, the Scarlet Spider story, like, series with him in it. Like, I haven't read all those. I thought you guys said it was kind of middling and not really worth reading. Is that, or
Kane's Scarlet Spider book was good, especially at the very beginning. It had amazing Ryan Stegman art. I think that's when I first kind of noticed Ryan Stegman. I was like, whoa, this guy's someone else. Like, he was really talented. So that was a really enjoyable book. A very weird point in time for Kane, though. Like, he doesn't have the scarring. It's post Spider Island. Like, there's a lot of, the character goes through so much in so many different ways. Like, he's been killed, resurrected as, like, a tarantula. Like, weird things have happened to him. But, you know, I still have a soft spot for him. And it's interesting looking at his powers and how they're presented here. I'm curious what fans at the time probably maybe thought he would have been, like, a mutant character. Like, he feels, like, if you don't know what we know, he presents like a mutant. He presents like a mutant menace. And again, all the trappings of a mystery mutant character, he kind of feels like that. Again, we know better because we know what he ends up being, but it's very interesting to kind of see that part of him. I do think between Web of Life and Web of Death, I've always preferred Web of Death. But I think the reason why, now that I really think about it, is that Web of Death gets to explore a civilian aspect of the character, whereas Scarlet Spider doesn't really have one yet. Like, he is Ben Reilly, but Ben Reilly doesn't really have a life yet. In many ways, he won't really have a life until he becomes Spider-Man. And then he gets a whole supporting cast of people, like Shirley at the Daily Grind and all those people. But really, it's not till then that he actually has a real life for the reader to understand and enjoy. So I think that's part of why in Web of Life, they have so much time given over to Grim Hunter, a character that no one really cares about that much, but he's given no offense to Howard Mackie, and I think he tries, and there's definitely some interesting ideas there, but I just think he was a little one note, and
yes,
they give him a lot of screen time that doesn't really go anywhere. But who else are you going to give screen time to? And then even Betty, kind of an odd love interest, and even then it was kind of like a half love interest, and then they kind of cycle back from it. So it's just, but I think it's because they had to fill the space, because he can't just be Scarlet Spider all the time on every page. They want other things to be going on, but Ben doesn't have a life yet. Ben doesn't have, and this is obviously part of his character, he doesn't really have an identity yet that we can really sink into. Yeah. Now, we start to see that because we have Sewer Trainer, who, again, mystery character, right? Like, it's just like, here's this random dude in a uniform from where is this uniform from? Well, it's not like he's just hanging out somewhere. He's in a uniform. Does he work somewhere? Like, there's all these questions that never get answered with Sewer Trainer. But at least you get some sort of character who understands who he is, and for fans at the time would have been like, whoa, this guy knows what's going on with Ben? Like, what's cellular degeneration? What's this? Like, so it starts to bring in a threat to Ben, something external that now we have to worry about, you know, something affecting Ben as well, which is interesting to see them bring it up this early. I don't think I realized that they brought up the idea of cellular degeneration for clones this early in the process.
Yeah, I really like the, and that's why I was bringing it before, like, any of that Betty stuff, I'm drawn to that, and it's gone after, you know, the second part of the story. He just kind of goes, oh, to think that I could have a life, have a normal life, I guess I'm gone. And, like, Betty's, like, into it. She's all like, you know, like, I don't know who you are, and you have no real face yet under that mask to me, but you're familiar. And he goes, oh, no, you're thinking of Peter. I'm gone. I'm out of here. And he just gets all angsty and leaves. And I'm like, no, stay. Like, she's into this, the weird kind of self-deprecating goth man. And then again, with anything to do with Trainer, and eventually when he meets Mary Jane, not in these storylines, and then she freaks out on him and stuff like that. But they have to, like, as I recall, it's a symbiote Carnage storyline or something like that, right? They have to fight over Venom. They've got to, like,
fight symbiotes. Later.
Yeah. And they're hanging out in an apartment together, and Mary Jane is like, look, I hate this guy, like, but he's kind of in Peter's life now, and like, what do you want? And you're trying to steal Peter's life. And they're like in an apartment together, and they like have to make space for each other. Like, anytime he's interacting with people on a person-to-person level, I'm really, really engaged by it. I want to see more from Ben. And then they just keep taking it away, and you're right, they don't really give us that until he becomes Spider-Man, and then they make us all love him, as we've covered before, and then they take him away. So it's quite a roller coaster with him, like wanting to access him more and not have him just be this one note. I'm not a man, not a hero, not even a person. And we're starting to see cracks in that in the series. We, as Paul mentioned in the preamble, he goes from like repeatedly hating this name, Scarlet Spider. He's like, I don't like it. It was, you know, given to me by Ken Ellis. I don't, you know, I'm going to sue you. And then just turns around. I mean, I want to see someone write a story in between the raindrops here of him coming to terms with this name. And now he's just like, and it's pronounced with two, it's hard S's. And the emphasis is on the first word. I'm like, oh, and now I even know how to pronounce it. It's not Scarlet Spider. It's Scarlet Spider. Like, he's so into it, telling all the members of the Sinister Six how to say his name. But where's that arc? You know, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's that little nugget of, I don't want to say inconsistency, but you have, you know, in a couple of books that he's the star, that, yeah, he's focused on grumbling about the name, but then you're right, then you have that moment where he's announcing, like, I know it's probably more for the reader's benefit, kind of, you know, declaring who he is, mm-hmm. more so than the yeah. villains in the story, but yeah, having that kind of turn on you, like, it almost think, okay, have you come to terms with this name that you've been complaining about hating for the past few issues? So it's a very interesting thing. And the other thing I wanted to get started quickly, only because you mentioned ripped sleeves earlier. So, like, Tombstone's the guy who rips the hoodie, right? And then I was flipping through really quickly. It seems to be fairly consistent. It remains ripped. I don't think I ever go as high as a new one afterwards. But
I love this. This is incredible. This deep dig baseball, right. Insider baseball about the status of the hood and from torn to untorn. Now we have to track this for the rest of the book club. Does he ever get a new hoodie?
Right.
This is really. I love this.
But the cover. The covers keep giving him the hood. But you're right.
Yes. Yeah. In the actual issues. Yeah. The unlimited one is hard to judge if it's complete or not, but at least for these first two storylines, they maintain rippage.
Yeah, it's interesting that you talk about the kind of the, I don't know, the almost meta aspect of naming, right? Like, this is part of the language of superhero comics, of these monthly serial comics, that whenever a character, like, what is that, you know, philosophy? Every comic's someone's first comic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is that a Jim Shooter? Is that a Shooter quote?
I thought it was a Stan Lee thing, but it might have been Shooter, too.
Oh. And so they're always declaring their names. Like, either you declare your name or someone else declares the name for you. So they could have just kept having people declare his name and having him just get mad at it. But at some point in time, they just had him start doing it. But yeah, it's not like these books are empty or you know, not having some... declaring Kane, like someone shouting Kane's name. I don't think he ever says his name. Like, in his head, he's like, oh, I'm Kane or whatever. I got a mark. But like, anytime someone sees him, it's like Ben Reilly yelling Kane or someone else saying Kane. Yeah. So... it's funny how they kind of just work that into the storyline and go like, well, eventually you just have to say your name to somebody. And what are you going to do? Call yourself the non-Spider? Another thing, another question for, like, you know, DeMatteis to maybe write about it at some point if they want to in a miniseries. What name was he thinking about? Like, he puts this costume on and he's like, oh, I'm drawn to this iconography. I can't get rid of this spider iconography. Did he have a name in mind? Like, he doesn't like the one he's given. Did he just want to be called the Spider? Do you want to be called nothing? I'm not a man. I'm nothing. I'm not a hero. Is that his? What did he want? Like, it's, anyway, I'm dwelling too much on this.
Clearly. That's okay. It does bring up.
I'm also paying attention to, like, you know, the Stan Lee or Marvel Presents, like, still, like, Web of Spider-Man, or now I Present Scarlet Spider, or Spider-Man and Scarlet Spider in this story. Like, you have a mix of the different characters depending on, you know, any individual issue. And I also noticed the flip from to Bob, from Tom, to Budiansky, from DeFalco, as of Web of Life Part 3 is when that kind of transition also takes place, where he's now the man in the chair navigating some of this nonsense. So I found that intriguing. Like, mid-story arc, this kind of happens in the Clone Saga, so that's kind of cool that I found as well.
I thought it was a lot later.
It's here in 121. Web of 121 is the first place I noticed it.
Interesting.
It's Bob.
Huh. It's interesting because in The Amazing Spider-Man that came out the same month, it doesn't show Bob yet. Oh, but it does when Spectacular. So that's interesting. Some of the issues, I guess, went out the door first. Interesting.
Yeah.
But at least, so, yes. So, two things there. So, yeah. So Bob is he's not the group editor. He's not the editor. He's the Spider-Man editor-in-chief. That becomes different later as well. But at the moment, Danny Fingeroth is still the editor of the books. So that hasn't changed yet. That will change later when it's just Bob. So right now we have Danny and you have Bob.
Okay.
And so at that point, Bob wouldn't have been as heavily involved because he's the EIC of the Spider-Man group as opposed to actually editing the book. But that will not always be the case because at some point Danny leaves too. But yeah, no, thanks for marking out exactly where that's happening. Poor Tom.
Are we moving on to Web of Death now? Like,
no.
I
have a couple more questions. First of all,
sure.
Do you guys hear Andy Samberg's voice in your head yet? For Ben?
I don't. No, not me.
Not even during the I'm Not a Man?
I hear my voice saying it in my own head. Because I read it and read, you know, some of these issues so many times as a youth that was in my head, but... I mean, he does an admirable job. He's having fun with it.
Yeah, he didn't do enough dialogue in the movie for it to be, like, the voice for me, to be honest. But I have no problem with Samberg, but there wasn't enough context there within the movie to make it.
If there's
a perfect pose line, that's the one I'll read back for sure.
True.
I just thank that movie for what I am going to assume is a domino effect, a causative kind of line between... that movie coming out and me being able to get Scarlet Spider as a Marvel United character in the most recent, well, I guess at the time of this recording, starter set, because he was, I guess, right, popular enough or interesting enough that they went, he's in this movie, and so when they start, merchandising some of the material from the movie, we get finally Ben Reilly stuff, and like there's T-shirts now where there wasn't before, and so I'm grateful for all of that, And now we're also over time of recording, we're in the midst of the deluge of X-Men 97 content and fan art and T-shirts and hopefully cereal boxes again. Like just having these things coming back. I was talking off air about like it really feels like the 90s are just around again, and it's quite amazing or weird to.
We also got the recent Mafex and Marvel Legends figures. Both are gorgeous as well that we all have. So,
is this what it was like for the boomers in like the 80s with like the Wonder Years and Back to the Future and like this constant references to their childhood? And they're like, oh, I feel like a kid again. Is that what this is like?
100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Because there's always something like that in every generation. There's some sort of throwback project that kind of harkens back and to some sort of shared memory that people have.
Well, at least for the like last 100 years, I suppose. Before that, people lived till 40, and there was no film. So you just like had, right? By the time someone was writing a book about your generation, you're dead. I don't know.
Harsh. One final thought, in a general thought, it was interesting how often Marvel's New York feels so small, and yet the two Spider-Men never meet for like a while.
Yeah.
And like it's crazy. Like we haven't even had them meet yet, but that'll be on our next episode. But like they're close to each other, like the Unlimited issue and also the Funeral for an Octopus.
Yeah.
Like they're in adjacent like rooms, but like not with each other. And it's just such a crazy. I almost applaud their restraint. Like they're like, no, let's keep these guys apart. It'll mean more when they meet together. But it's really something to see.
Yeah, there's really a lot of ships passing the night for sure, right? And it's like, how hasn't Peter heard about this? Like he kind of, I think a little bit later in one of the issues, there's like that Peter's kind of over this other vigilante going about. But everyone else, like when he finds the village, oh no, you're not a real Spider-Man. You're the imposter guy we're hearing about. So everyone's getting the words on the street about this other spider. None of them at any point ever assume he could be the real Peter at any point. They're all like, no, you're some half bit, whatever, right? But then he goes, yeah, I guess you're right. But then he starts whipping, the impact webbing and the stunners and all these different gizmos. He's fighting them in a different way. So, he's like, oh, yeah, you're definitely not. Because like I mentioned before with the costumes, like they're different spiders. They fight different. They feel different. And that starts to, ingrain the personalities of each of them. Despite the clonage, Ben is very much a whole, his own person.
This is the mystery of slingers before they do the mystery of slingers, right? Like there's another player in town. And like, who is it? Is it just another Spider-Man? But yeah, this is also on the cusp of. Now we do have photographs. Okay, back to what you were saying though. Before I get to like the technological kind of shifts here, there's still people who photograph, like have cameras. You can take pictures of things. And again, Ken Ellis and Betty Brant are doing stories on this guy. Like they're writing about him actively. He's come to visit Ben. So like there's firsthand accounts and conversations with someone who's like, I'm not a hero. I'm nobody. I'm not Spider-Man. Ken's like, I'm going to call you Scarlet Spider. He's like, I hate you. Like none of this is like. And then there's another Spider-Man swinging around going, I'm going to die, I'm dying, I hate life, I'm a weirdo, I'm going to make a cocoon for myself. So, like, people are seeing two different costumes, two different personalities, and there's cameras, and, like, he's at the funeral, Doc Ock, and he's swinging away, and Ben is still convinced, he's like, I got to get out of here, before Peter realizes there's another Spider-Man in this city. And you're like, what? So, like, all of these...
But Peter is very distracted, right? He's just coming out of cocoon land and the spider stuff, and now...
Yeah, he's
on the way because we're going to jump into. So I guess his mind is clearly elsewhere, but it is interesting that, there's no weird.
The internet does exist. This is like, 95 or whatever? Like, the internet exists. It's very early and crude, but, like, the technology they have, the hoops they have to jump through. So, like, this is a funeral for an...
But these guys don't have enough money for the internet right now.
No, because, look, okay, so, like, Elias Hargrove has got this machine, this insane Kirby-esque machine.
At a briefcase,
The briefcase, which is like video camera, like it's a projector and some sort of satellite dish in order to allow you to watch a video. Like it's crazy the weird kind of analog technology they have when there was an early internet. People could use like, that modem to kind of log onto the phone line and post on a website, hey, sightings of a different Spider-Man. But everything is so excruciating. Everything is so slow. And then in the 10 years, it'll jump and all the Marvel characters still have phones and they'll just be like texting each other. It's a fascinating shift. This is the last kind of era of Marvel being allowed to do these things and have these secrets or mysteries in the same way, right? It wouldn't fly now.
No. Well, it's interesting that you bring it up because, in less than a year at this point, when you have the Scarlet Spider books, isn't that the whole virtual reality storyline? Like, that's going to be rough going.
Yeah, and Joystick is part of the, you know, the game. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is that she's like, I'm kind of a gamer, but I don't know what video games are because I was created by a boomer. But like, I'm related to video games somehow. So
that's still better than what we're seeing at the exact same time. Oh, no. In Daredevil. Absolutely. Daredevil's doing batshit crazy stuff with the internet too. So, like,
it's everything. It's Johnny Mnemonic. It's all these things. It's Lawnmower Man with virtual reality. It's all these, like, too soon kind of references to a virtual world. This is what the kids like. This is what you'll like this. And then they do Reboot, and you might argue they did it right. But they do some weird things in Reboot also that they might not make that same mistake today. So it is a weird era.
Reboot doesn't actually make any sense. Like, I love that show, but, like, the idea that, like, the games are destroying the computer doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
When we get to those issues of Scarlet Spider, I think we just need to talk about Reboot. We probably have to watch Reboot and read those issues. That was cool. You want context, Adam, it's Chapman's Context Corner.
Don't you worry. So I got to ask, so how did you guys feel about, one, the Grim Hunter in terms of his personality, his part of the story is trying to avenge his father, and then also how did you feel about Kane taking him out? Although it's unclear, what does he crack? Because we hear a crack, and then he dies.
I assume the neck.
But he's still alive at first, and I feel like he'd be dead faster.
Well, he's mostly dead. to quote Princess Bride. Yeah, that's a bit of an odd thing, but I assume when they do that off-panel crack thing, which, again, he does to Doc Ock, right? Like, he's a nutcracker.
Yeah, but he's, like, dead right away. He doesn't get a moment to be like, Gregor, I have failed, forgive me. Like, he doesn't get this moment.
Yeah, but he's not juiced up on that weird potion that he got, right? So maybe that's what gives Kravenoff the ability to do one more line or something. I don't know.
It's going to, like, snap his arm or something. That's going to be his neck. Maybe he breaks his arm. You know, so he can prostrate him.
To me, it's clear that Kane's signature moves are twofold. The Mark of Kane, where he burns your face, and then he does a neck snap. That's his second move. Those are his two moves. It's like Roadhouse with Patrick Swayze. He does the throat rip. Like, two or three throat rips in one movie. It becomes, like, his telltale signature thing. I assume it's a neck crack, and then can you talk after a neck crack? Maybe you can.
I always thought no, but who am I to judge?
He's juiced up.
Because you brought it up, so in this period, November to December 1994, there were episodes 5 to 10 of Reboot Season 1. So it was on the air. It was in the ether. It was on ABC in the States. And then later on, it would eventually just be on YTV, and I would argue be a much better show once it wasn't constrained by regular network standards. But that's me. So, Paul, any thoughts on Grim Hunter? Did you care about him at all? Did they get you to care?
There was a little bit of curiosity, of course. You know, we did see, you know, some level of Kraven stuff coming out of the Life Theft stories we read before. But, you know, the design's actually kind of cool. Like, it's a very 90s version, like, update if you were going to make him young, make him hip, give him some cool armor. The classic Cable arm going on there. Big mane on the other side. So
That mane is so inconsistent with just how gigantic it is. There are shots where it's all mane. Like, what is happening?
You get a cool futuristic photon spear thing that can shoot beams. Yeah, why not? Sure, let's go with it, right? Blows up a car.
Now, Gregor does show up again. He shows up in Kazar a couple years later. And just in the last year, J.M. DeMatteis brought the character back for a story set during Peter Parker's time in Oregon, Portland, Oregon. And Gregor tracked him down. So you should go check that out. And that's the Lost Hunt.
Is it ever explained in Kazar what's going on with him not being dead?
With Gregor?
Yeah.
Well, Gregor never died.
Oh, I assumed he died with the crack, and that's just like...
No, that's Grim Hunter. Gregor's the attendant, the guy who's looking after him.
Yeah. Oh, okay, sorry. I swapped the names in my head for some reason.
No, you're talking about Vladimir. Vladimir?
Yeah, it is. I'm pretty sure it's Vlad.
And at this point, he was the only son of Kraven that we'd never seen before. Obviously, later on, he would get another son, Aloysia, and later still, he would get a daughter, Anna. Later still, they introduced his wife still alive. Later still, he cloned himself many times and raised them as his sons. And then later still, his clone son killed him. So, a lot of fun stuff. Because, I also forgot to mention, Kraven came back from the dead. That happened during Grimhunt. He was mad at his family for doing it, and then murdered most of his family for bringing him back. Just a few things, because the only way he could be killed again is if Spider-Man killed him, who would never kill him. And he was like,
I'm now we're getting a Kraven movie.
Yay!
I'm sure that'll be amazing and not like Madam Web at all.
All right, let's talk about Web of Death. This is Amazing Spider-Man 397 to 398. In Spectacular Spider-Man 218 to 219.
The last Spidey Doc Ock saga of all time.
That's right. These characters never interact again.
Well, it's funny. So, and I've read this in the Life of Riley archives, but DeFalco was against the idea of them killing Doc Ock. He said it was not a good idea to kill off like a legacy character just to prove the bona fides of another character. So he was very much against them doing it, but again, he wasn't in charge anymore, and he actually is the one who wrote his death. So he was writing that issue of Spectacular where he died. Now, the first chance Tom got, he brought back Doc Ock. So right after the Clone Saga, maybe 6 months after it ended, he brought him back in a mystical ceremony by an offshoot of the Hand called the True Believers, and they brought him back to life. So he was against it from the start, and the minute he got the chance, he reversed it.
I do love the suit. I'm a big fan of the... I know before we ask this question, I'm just going to answer it. Feelings on the suit. I know we've got like the green and orange kind of onesie thing that he has for years. I like the suit. I'm a big fan of it. I just think it kind of works. I mean, this is very early Ditko-esque. We're going to bring the callback and, I don't know, overpower cards off.
Overpower. Yeah, I was going to mention that, yeah.
Yeah.
The suit. So for me, I'm a big suit fan for Doc Ock.
Yeah, me too. Eric Larson is the one who kind of started it, putting him in the suit. So this wasn't a Bagley creation. Bagley was just kind of picking up the baton. However, I do think I love how, like, the first shot we get of Doc Ock when he's kind of holding Spider-Man in his tentacles. What I like about it, Larson is very kinetic, and so he made the arms, like, everywhere and everything, and, like, super crazy, you know, in terms of how far the tentacles were going, etc. And I think Bagley really reins that in, and so there's just something a little bit more controlled about how he draws the tentacles. And so I am so enamored with his take on Doc Ock here. I don't think anyone ever makes him look better. There's just something about him. They give him that sense of dignity that I think works best for the character when he kind of holds himself in a different way. But at the same time, you can see the madness as well. At times you have him looking less, you know, portly than usual, but then there's certain shots where you can kind of see it. You start to see his age in terms of his face. But in general, I'm such a huge fan of this. As a kid, like, Stunner seemed really cool to me. And, like, now knowing that really it's just Mark Bagley wanting to draw She-Hulk, makes sense, because that's definitely how the character comes across. What I like about her is that she is an interesting character in that she's so in love with the physicality that she has now. Now, at the time, we don't know her backstory. Big surprise, we don't know anyone's backstory at this point in time in Spider-Man comics. But I just love how she seems to really just love having her abilities, being super strong, being a badass. Like, she's just in love with that idea. And we don't see enough of characters like that, just reveling and really just enjoying having almost pure fun at being this physical a beast.
Yeah, Bagley in 397, can't say enough good about him here. He is firing on all cylinders, like some good rain shots. It was page two, doing like a fisheye lens, low angle shot of Peter flipping around in front of the moon, a full moon, like really playing with angles. You're right about the arms. You're like the kinetic kind of frenzy of Doc Ock's arms also in the rain. So there's a lot of interesting line work going on. The Stunner's good. I feel like things start to break apart a little bit somehow. Like, she starts doing weird poses. I wonder if Mark was just kind of pulling things out of magazines of her just inexplicably on the ground, and then she's squatting and doing...
There's some stuff in there, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty solid. Like, one of these, the Scream of Anguish, which is, God, what is this page? I don't know, somewhere towards the end. After Mary Jane comes in and she's kind of going like, oh my gosh, what's going on, Peter? He has another flashback to being in a pod, to being like a little clone baby. And this awful scream in his mask, again, going back to the really squinty, small, Ditko-ass blind, eyes. Just some really great emotion in here. Love it. Really good art. Fantastic issue for that reason.
It's funny, at the beginning of that issue, even leading up to seeing Doc Ock, you know, in person, you have like two pages where first you just see his silhouette, and then you see the tentacles kind of pulling out and like kind of knocking Spider-Man and then picking him up by the neck. Then you see the reflection in his glasses, and then you have this great reveal shot. Like, I don't have the original issue at hand at the moment, but I'm curious about the page flips, like what that was like to kind of, like, you know what you're about to get, but there's just something really great about that establishing shot that really proves the menace. And like, a lot of this storyline is, you know, Doc Ock trying to save Spider-Man, which is very against type. Also, it's Doc Ock finding out that Spider-Man's Peter Parker, which, again, at the time, would have felt really exciting. Like, oh my God, he knows who Peter is. This is back before everyone seems to know. And, like, Ultimate Spider-Man made a joke of it, that everyone learned who Peter Parker was. There was no suspense there. But at the time, in Amazing Spider-Man, not a lot of people knew. You had Venom, but, like, how many other people who were villains really knew who Spider-Man was? So the idea that is, you know, one of his biggest, most long-term nemesis actually knew who he was a big deal. So, I mean, it's interesting reading it now. You're like, well, of course they were about to kill off Doc Ock. You don't let him find that out without knowing you're about to either wipe his mind somehow or you know, kill him off. So it's interesting. But then you get that amazing issue with Mark Bagley firing in all cylinders. And then Nate already knows what I'm going to say. You get to Sal Buscema on Spectacular Spider-Man 220. And I like Sal Buscema, but my least favorite inker of Sal Buscema comes on board when you have Bill Sienkiewicz, or Sienkiewicz, I forget how to pronounce it.
Sienkiewicz,
yes, thank you. He comes in and he inks the crap out of Sal Buscema to the point where I think you forget where Sal Buscema was even here. It just feels like a Bill piece, and I think that's to its detriment. I don't think the pencils can support the super heavy line work. It's kind of grotesque at times. Like, you have these moments, like, it's so tragic to me that MJ's big moment of saying she's having a baby, and she looks like this. Like, this is not MJ. This is just not what I want to see. I want to see a Mark Bagley version. I want, like, when we see Peter's reaction.
The cover's good, though. You don't have an issue with the cover, right?
I don't think Bill did the inks there, though, because it doesn't feel as heavy.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Are you not referring to that? Are you referring to an inner one of the pages inside?
I'm talking about the last page of the issue. It's very heavily inked and too much.
Like, I'm okay with that. That one's like actually the least egregious page in terms of like heavy inks to me. Like, there's a lot of other ones where, like, even like, I don't. Well, maybe I have a question here. Who's responsible for trying to convey an image of Kane in this? Like, does Sal not know what Kane's costume is, or does like Sienkiewicz just like ink all over it? Like, there's almost no, like, you can't tell what Kane is. His mask almost like. I'm trying to show you boys. Yeah, it's like it almost doesn't have a mask anymore. Like, so he gets butchered in this one. I don't know who's responsible for that. Maybe even the inker doesn't know how to. Sorry, not the inker. The colorist doesn't know to color his face gray. So
it's possible.
That's one of the more egregious pieces here for me. The rest of it, I'm fine with. I don't have the same strong feelings that Adam does. Paul, how do you feel about it?
Well, I just want to comment quickly. The reflection in Doc Ock's eye, spells like Deadpool.
Yes, he did.
Very much like Deadpool. It's squinty eyes and the no lens on the mask. I'm with Adam on this. The art does kind of really go downhill. Yeah, the cover with Hey Tiger, do I have news for you? Like, oof, that's not the prettiest Mary Jane that I've ever seen. But yeah, it seems like really rushed, and like it kind of gives the book a whole different tone too. Like, from going from one to the next. I know that, you know. Whether it's intentional or not, I don't know, but it's just not as enjoyable if it was done by more Bagley or a better artist that had like just a little more synergy, I guess, between the books, right?
I do think, like, if you look at Web of Life, you know, Tom Lyle and Stephen Butler are not the same, but theirs are still tonally similar overall. Like, I don't feel like I get Whiplash from going from one issue to the next, whereas this one I felt that more so. Now, looking at it again, it does look like, you know, Sal's just doing breakdowns. So it makes sense that you'd have more of a Bill flourish. I just don't know if Bill was the right call. And I've always said that and always will. And Ron friends can politely tell me that, well, it's still good work, but it's, you know, it's just not my cup of tea. But I do think as a kid, I read this type of art. And I was like, I don't like Sal Buscema because I didn't understand the nuance. I didn't understand what inkers really did. I probably didn't for many years. I didn't understand what they could bring to a project. If I had really thought about it and looked at an issue like this, and even just look at the, you know, the Daredevil issue of Spectacular that Sal did, you know, Sal's stuff there at times, like his Daredevil face was kind of rough, right? That first page. But overall, I still liked the art, whereas here, I just found myself more turned off by it because I just found the angst to be too heavy. I like Bill as an artist. I think he's a really interesting artist. I don't know if I like him as an inker, but I do think he's a really good penciler and an artist when he's doing pencils and inks on himself. I think the best type of inker, and this is something I get into in actually my last episode with Joe Rubenstein, talking about how the inker's real job is to accentuate what makes that penciler special, not to bring anything about yourself. And so he always says, like, the best thing is that if someone can't tell that he inked it, that's almost a good thing because it looks like the intention of the original penciler. I don't think this was any of Sal's original intent. That's my problem with it.
Could you have him on the show and ask him?
If only. He's like in his 80s and I don't think he does interviews and I would love to talk to Sal. I don't even know what I would tell him because I don't want to say anything negative about the man. And again, now that I can look back on it, I love his art when he's doing his run with JMD, when he's doing The Child Within, some of the great storytelling. He really understands how to tell stories without even needing narration. It's just I found that this wasn't my favorite of his work and I think it's Bill's fault.
So my big takeaways from this issue, A Time to Live, is Doc Ock has decided that, and this is very like almost like Killing Joke, like Alan Moore, like the villain and the hero becoming united or one or dependent on each other and interdependent. And so I'm nothing without you and I need you in my life or whatever, right? So like he's going to bring Peter back to life and then he tries to, and in pain, Peter gets flashback to again being a clone. Lashes out, flips out, leaves the laboratory, jumps out into the, you know, bouncing around, hits Stunner, jumps outside and gets kind of like, I guess, saved. And then he wakes up in costume. He's like, I'm back. I'm okay. The big thing for me, this is the first time that Peter and Mary Jane have seen each other, been together without like, you know, running into each other partially in the apartment. And I won't, you know, don't leave me, Peter. Like you've gone into the next room and I'm begging you to talk to me, or I run into the room and you jumped out through the skylight, or I go into the room and you're in a cocoon, or I'm going to see my sister and I'm going to leave for several days. Like it's been a lot of just kind of estrangement and really rough time for them.
Absolutely. And right. They have that one moment of solace. I remember in Life Theft where they do, I guess when they consummate the baby at that point, right? Because they have that one touching moment. He's still, you know, takes off first thing in the morning afterwards, but you thought that would be the first step to their road to reconciliation, and then this is you're right, this is the final moment they finally come back together, or they've rekindled their love for each other, and they're back on the same page, and there's no longer, you know, again, the spider, right? He's passed all of that. He's now, you know, who he wants to be, and knows where his future wants to go. So they're laying the foundation down for kind of the pass off here, but with also like planting the seeds of the mystery of, you know, who's really the clone, right? I didn't realize it was this early that they were starting to kind of do these, you know, who's the clone baby flashback stuff, right? But you tend to see it more happen to Peter's perspective, less so than Ben, right? So I guess that was probably intentional on their part too, to kind of make that mystery start.
For me, yeah, this is the heart of this issue. Like, I am slightly interested in seeing this kind of new developing relationship or feeling or philosophy for Octavius, for Peter. Like, oh, you're actually, your nobility is what I'm drawn to. We're actually more alike than we think. I wish I could be more noble. I wish I could be more like you. You're my greatest foe. So that's neat. But this is really stressful. These pages of, like, Peter gets home after being revived by Doc Ock, Mary Jane's back in town. She goes to see Aunt May. She's like, will he talk to me? Does he love me? Will he want to see me again? Is our marriage over? And then it just builds and builds and builds, and they see each other in the apartment, and they like reach for each other, and it's just really very evocative. And I wish there was a bit more of this focused in the issue, and maybe a little bit less of like, you know, Doc Ock peering in on them in a weird, creepy way. But it builds to that revelation, of course, of like she's pregnant, and this is, you know, Marvel trying to point them towards a happy ending, like they tried before with Cyclops and Madeline. He's going to leave the team, go have a baby, go to Anchorage, they'll be happy, and they can never let them be happy, can they? No. Peter's going to have Mary Jane are going to have a baby, and they're going to go away, and Ben's going to be Spider-Man, and what could have been, you know? They could have Mayday.
Well, all I can think of when I'm reading the Doc Ock kind of change your heart is, like, Superior Spider-Man, right? Like, knowing, obviously, now what I know. I don't know if this is like Dan Slott's kind of inspiration behind it all, or if this, I know, or maybe there's more of this type of stuff. You know Spider-Man history way more than I do, Adam.
It does feel like it. It does seem like this is an inspiration for Slott later on, right?
No.
I think you're probably right. I mean, he is a student of Marvel history and loves mining things and bringing things back and bringing back characters, so that wouldn't surprise me. In Amazing Spider-Man 398, so that's Web of Death Part 3, at the end we have him taking the antidote that's supposed to save him, and it kind of makes him flatline, and he goes almost to the other side, and you have this moment with Aunt May, and he's talking with, you know, kind of her ghost or his whatever in his mind, and she says what he will tell her in two issues, which is, you know, the thing from Peter Pan, second start of the right street on Until Morning, which has more impact if you remember what the gift is in issue 400. Like, if you've read that and remember that and that stuck with you, going back and reading this again, you're like, oh yeah, this is what he's talking about. Like, this is what, how he is able to ease her suffering later, and how he is able to kind of tell her to, you know, to do what she needs to do. It starts here. And I like that whole moment. I mean, it's a very Peter Parker thing that, you know, have his kind of haunted by the ghosts of his past. It's always a trope they go to with Peter, but I do like the idea of him almost passing on to the other side while he's trying to recover from this, you know, this deadly virus. Even earlier in the issue, when he finds out that they're going to have a baby, it's almost the flip from what you usually see with Peter, because first he's absolutely elated, and then immediately the world sets in. He's like, oh man, like, what about all the bad things that could happen? And I feel like usually it's the other way with Peter. He usually goes bad first and then sees the bright side. So it was interesting to kind of see him just get to revel for a moment before the weight of the world sunk back down on him. And it was nice because you want to see the character be happy. He's been through so much shit. Like, now that we've actually gone through it all, and like, how many months has it been where Peter's had like no life? Have we barely seen him do anything as Peter, right? Because he's just been the Spider. How are their bills being paid? Here are my questions. But like, Ben's for that matter, like, they don't really have lives at this point. They're just kind of the Spiders, which is interesting to see. I like that juxtaposition. And then I loved Otto being, you know, so set with like, I'm going to save you so that we can fight, because we're going to fight forever. Like, I kind of like that, because, you know, it was not that many years earlier. Well, I guess maybe a decade earlier, where he had a paralyzing fear of Spider-Man. Like, he would see Spider-Man's picture and he would break out into sweats. Like, he was so nervous. And then this is a version where he's very secure in himself, almost too secure. Maybe it's because he knows he's superior. But, you know, it's just this idea.
Look at that suit, though. He's got a great suit he's wearing now.
He's got a great suit. He's got the girl. You know, he's very confident. And then Kane takes it all away.
Yeah. I feel like it's just the spectacular issues. And maybe the art invokes it. Like, you know, the amazing issues are like all the happy stuff. And then they go dark with all the spectacular stuff. Like, I'm still trying to figure out what's going on here with Mary Jane cleaning her house in the cut-off jean shorts and the crop top. Because that's just...
Is that not how your wife does it?
Yeah, it seems a little gratuitous.
Yeah, right?
A little bit.
For a woman who's pregnant, right, here she is just prancing about as slutty as can be, cleaning the house, scrubbing the toilets, like, what? Who? Why? Like, really 90s,
it's an it's an odd tonality to it. Tone is all odd.
Yeah, and here comes Peter, like, all decked out in a suit, flowers, and the crib ready to go. Like, mm-hmm. just, what is happening here, right?
So, no. I mean, again, Mary Jane's a model and used to showing skin, and she's in her own home, so it's also, like, fine or whatever, but it is just the way it's drawn, right? The way that the angles and the shots, and then Stunner kind of juxtaposing back and forth with her and the way that her body is shown. So it's not necessarily the greatest time for, like, character for the ladies. Right. Often get enough of her. There's a bit too much emphasis on their bodies, but Stunner, I guess, loves them. Mm-hmm. Doc Ock, nevertheless, like, she's definitely kissing and posing for him a lot, but that's not really developed enough to make this as impactful of a loss for her, because she's barely a character.
So we're about at my self-imposed time, but we haven't talked about Funeral for an Octopus. That being said, I don't know if there's a lot to say about it, because it is a fairly light read. It's, as I said before, you're seeing Spider-Man and Scarlet Spider in an adventure, but not together, so they're always in different rooms. What is interesting about it, and of note, is it's co-written by Tom Brevoort.
On B-board, yeah.
So, you know, everyone's favorite Avengers editor and soon-to-be X-Men editor. He co-wrote this with his frequent writing partner, Mike, was it, Kanarowski? It's hard to tell because the credits are so dark. It's Mike Kantorovich.
I was going to say, like, the volumes that we have, I kind of can't wait for the new epics because this is some rough reading sometimes. It's very blurry and the inks have bled.
Yeah, it's not great. You got Stuart Johnson on breakdowns, Al Milgram on finishes. The art's actually not bad for the most part. I would say it gets a little sketchy in the third issue because I think that one they were up against a deadline. Because if you look at the artists there...
It's a different artist, right? Because Stuart Johnson is here and then it switches, right?
Yeah, and the last issue has breakdowns by Todd Smith with then finishes by Milgram, Sal Buscema, and Hudson. So you got three different finishers really trying to kind of make this thing work. And it shows. Whereas I would say the first two issues are actually surprisingly, you know, enjoyable. The art's fairly good and consistent with each other.
I really like them. I think that Johnson does a great job in these first two movies. I was going to say that one of the standouts of these is the art and these, like, you know, medium shots or sometimes splashes or half pages of the Sinister Six. Really good depictions of all of them. They look menacing and, you know, interesting. Like, I really like the art in general in these first two issues, especially. Big fan.
I've always been partial to the amazing Octo Spidey, which is just a great visual. And again, something we saw in the animated series later on. They adapted this version in the last two episodes when you had the original Spider-Verse. And so one of the versions of Spider-Man that showed up there had the octopus arms.
And
I just think it's a great design. It's a very fun visual, you know, seeing... Suddenly, you know, all the villains are there charged up and suddenly they're all getting hit in the face by tentacles. And you're like, wait, what? And again, I'm curious what the page flip was like there. Like if you actually had to flip the page or if it was just the next page, like it is in these volumes. And I guess I should say we are reading from the Complete Clone Saga Epic Volume 2. In general, I thought this was a fun story. It made sense to kind of put it in its own miniseries because it doesn't further the main essence of the plot that they wanted to be telling the stories, but at the same time, they had to address it in some way. Doc Ock, such a major villain, was killed. It's interesting that they didn't get a more, no offense to Tom Brevoort, but that they didn't get a more prestige creative team to kind of work on this. It does feel like who's around, who's nearby, who can work on this. And so...
Yeah, well, when the dialogue is, I wouldn't worry about old Doc Ock's booty if I were you. That goes to show the A-list they found for this. But this was boys playing with their toys, 100%. Like, let's get the figures out. Let's mash them together. Let's throw some octo arms on Spidey for shits and giggles. You know, you have, you know, it's funny that you first have Ben involved fighting these guys. Then they, you know, they incapacitate him by throwing a roof on him. Then Peter gets involved and he's the main star. And then Ben unburies himself and he comes in at the end. So it's that kind of, you know, that crisscross. We keep talking about the ship's passing like, between the two characters. But this is to me is just, you know, everyone having fun and, you know, just showing that, yeah, you know, Ben can take on four members of the Sinister Six all by himself, no problem. You have this weird kind of character you shoehorn in there, this, you know, last heir of Ox family. What's his name here? I can't remember now.
Elias
Marbro, yeah, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure, whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, a little bit of recapping of, you know, from Life Theft and you know, just respect to Doc Ock for keeping alive and wanting to do goodbye him, where Ben is like has no idea why people are mourning this guy's death. So it's very interesting kind of you know, look points of view, I guess, by our two heroes. But yeah, this is pretty much, you know, just playing with her toys and then, you know, and moving on.
I do like, again, how they're writing Peter, because this is nice to, he's coming out of the darkness, right? And so he's like,
yes.
You know, as much as Doc Ock was a villain, he's also trying to do right by the fact that he saved his life and he did not have to. He went out of his way to save his life, so he's going to try and find his killer, and which is nice. And I don't think they really address that anywhere else after this. Like, I don't think they really talk about the fact that, you know, he's trying to find the guy who killed him. Obviously, he ends up finding him pretty easily because it's Kane, and Kane is everywhere, and Kane is watching you. But at the time, he wouldn't have known that. So it's interesting. And I should mention, this was not specific to these three issues, but in general, we're starting to see some of the subplots that are going to matter a lot later. Like, you're seeing Jacob Raven showing up looking for, you know, a murder suspect, you know, who killed his partner. So you're starting to plant the seeds. And if you remember Lost Years, like, this is all clicking into place. Like, oh, shit. Like, I know where this is going, or at least I know what this story is about. So it's interesting to kind of see how much track they're starting to lay. Although I would say it feels like more of the track is being laid in the Jam DeMatteis and Tom DeFalco written issues, as opposed to the Terry Cavanaugh and Howard Mackey. And, you know, Howard Mackey has been said to not be a great lover of continuity or a great user of continuity. And that kind of shows, where he just kind of likes to do his own thing. Whereas the other guys are definitely, you know, building up subplots and trying to build things in and really work with continuity.
I'm just glad that that virus is finally done. It went on for what, 8 months? Like that virus really was a thing for Peter for like, it's like the longest time, right? Started life staff, and now.
But the virus.
I know, but it felt like it. Him having this virus and trying to fight through it, it just felt like it dragged on. Like, is he cured? He's not cured. Yeah. Now he's cured again. Like, that was one. This is nagging storyline. It just wouldn't go away. Like he had the 100-day cough. Yeah. Like,
hold on. But he only got the virus. He only got the virus and Back from the Edge Part 3. So it's been like 2 months tops.
Right, well, so the like number six of epics to me worth.
When you're reading six or eight issues of it, yeah, it feels like a long time.
I guess, but it didn't feel like too much to me, because like he got infected in one issue, the next issue he takes an antidote, it ends up not being real, and then you have these four issues. That's it. Like the total amount of time he was sick. And really, in the part four of this one, he's already not sick, but I'll count that as well. So at most, it's six. But I would agree, his mental malaise has been forever, because that was since
life. It's a lot. It goes hand in hand with that. It's a lot to read, especially because it doesn't come off of an uptick, right? You're supposed to do uptick and then downtick. That's not roller coasters work. When you just have down, doesn't feel so good. But I do like these three issues overall. I think, from like in terms of a complete storyline out of all these so far, this one just feels like the most interesting to me. The most is going on here. There's not issues in between of just nothing happening, of characters just running around the city. Like, when there's been issues happening, he feels like he has something to do. Like in the third issue, he's fighting Mysterio and he's got to solve a problem. Like, oh, there's a room full of Mysterios. I'm going to use my problem solving skills and just going to hit them all with impact weapon. Oh, they're all illusions. Therefore, it must be. The answer is staring you right in the face. It was actually Elias the entire time was an illusion. Like, and then they're having a tete-a-tete. Like, I don't know. Like, it just seems like everyone has something to do. There's something fun going on. The amazing Occo Spidey is fun. That feels like Brevoort kind of going. Mm-hmm. It's not just, again, toys smashing into each other, but there are fun ideas that almost feel a little bit more like Silver Age, or even maybe, Silver Age comics. So the arts and generally the pacing, I'm okay with. I think I like these the most, and I didn't expect to say that from this collection of books. I overall felt they were page turners.
Last but not, well, actually, certainly at least, Spider-Man Unlimited number 8. This was not good, but it's it's interesting. It's written by Tom Lyle and Ron Lim. What? Okay, that's two artists that, you know, I do like. Let's have them write something. I don't think this was anyone's best work. But breakdowns are by Palmer, Milgram, and Candelario, and Hannah, with finishes by Joe Rosen. So that's just a smorgasbord. You know, this is a book that comes out, I think it's quarterly. So this comes out every 3 months, and this is the best they could do. Like, it just feels like it's another book that they have to pump content into. It feels very superfluous. It feels like it didn't need to be here, and you wouldn't have missed anything.
Ugly.
Yeah, it's not great art. I will say the one thing I did like about it, which did feel very on the nose, though, is you have the second last page. You have Peter talking to a cop, and I guess Ben talking to another cop, and saying kind of the parallel things about, you know, all they care about is doing the right thing because they care. I did like that. That's probably the only thing I liked about the entire issue. Then you get to the next page, and it's one of those things of like they didn't have to put both Spider-Men on the same image in a way that makes it look like Scarlet Spider's just like swinging by and goes, oh, there's Peter. I should go this way. Like, it feels very silly. Like, there's a way that they could have done it as like a split image where you knew that they were in two different places and you're just kind of seeing both Spider-Men kind of swinging by. This just felt like an awkward composition. But in general, it was kind of an ugly book, and the villain is so forgettable. You know, just kind of randomly murdering their own people or their own shooting their own people just because they can, and no one seems to say anything about the guy who just did that. Like, it's very bizarre.
I am so sad about the dad that gets flat out murdered, and MJ like takes the son. Like, my kid has to be bam, like that. Like, what? And nobody cares. And even MJ at the time was like, oh, I better stop talking. He might shoot me too. I'll go deal with him now. Like, it was so, the dialogue and some of the thought was just very interesting. Obviously, the Twin Towers also being a touchy subject, obviously no way after the fact. But yeah, very, I always found these unlimited issues and some of the annuals, like, they tend to be these really weird, out of context or continuity of what's going on at the time, just nonsense that don't mean a lot of anything. They're an extra size and they cost you more money, and I very rarely have encountered one that I've ever enjoyed. It's probably very few and far between.
We have one in our future. We have the super specials from 1995 coming up in our future. It was a flip book that in the Clone Saga epics, they split up the stories. There's a Venom storyline, or Planet of the Symbiote storyline, and there's also a storyline with Scarlet Spider that introduces a new version of the Lizard. Originally, they were in a flip book. They put them very separate from each other in these Clone Saga epics, but I cannot wait till we get to that, because that basically is an annual that's not called an annual. I would say at times enjoyable, and at times a frightful symbiote mess.
That Venom storyline is what I'm talking about. I was referring to earlier about how there's a little bit of, that's where, they're hanging out at the apartment, mm-hmm. and Mary Jane and Riley's there, and I think Venom's there too, right? Like, so that, there is some enjoyable stuff in there that I recall, but yeah, the art, I don't always remember being solid. And a lot of just like squiggly, diddly, symbiote. Yeah.
I'll have to check. Basically,
it's like watching those Venom movies, right? Where like Venom mm-hmm. fights another oil slick, and then he fights a red oil slick in the next one, and everything's just like serpentine, and everything's the same. Those are a rough reading sometimes.
I will have to check the chronology, because the first time in continuity that's supposed to be that MJ ever sees Ben Reilly is supposed to be after the death of Aunt May, but I don't know if those super specials came out before or not, but it definitely is, because the whole idea that it reveals that he pulls off his mask, he's like, it's time we spoke face to face, and it's like this big, like, oh my god, you're Peter, like, you look like Peter. So but I'll have to check
the exact chronology. Like, get out of my life, who are you, what's happening, I'm tired of imposters, what is going on. Like, yeah, she has a big freak out, which
she doesn't even know how bad it's gonna get.
No. Yeah,
so many clones.
Yeah, maybe maximum clonage even.
Oh my god, I would love to know which marketing exec was like,
yeah, we can do this. Yeah. It's the same kind of, consonant, same syllable, mm-hmm. right? The maximum carnage, maximum clonage. We can do this. Okay.
I was talking before about the long shadow that Age of Apocalypse has. So even there, you have maximum clonage Omega and Alpha. Like, you have these Alpha and Omega issues because X-Men did it and it was a big hit, so they got to do it again. Like, it's interesting. Again, the X-Office was really driving the ship in terms of if they did something and it was successful, everyone else kind of tried to mimic it, because they were the ones selling the biggest books.
We can do see-through covers or foil covers or lenticular covers. We can do something. Look, covers. People like covers, right? Death of Spider-Man. We love that stuff, right? Put it in a bag.
Yeah.
If you put it in a bag.
We will get to this in the future, in the next episode, I guess, but Bob Budiansky, his first variant cover for the Spider-Man office that he had to shepherd was 400. And 400 is supposed to be a tombstone, but it doesn't look like anything, unfortunately. But the idea was that 400 was supposed to be a tombstone because you're killing off Aunt May. It was supposed to be indicative of that. But unfortunately, if you look at that cover, it does not look like anything. It's just this mass of gray. So there was definitely a lot of lessons to be learned. It's too bad they couldn't have learned on an issue that wasn't 400, like a big one. Like, it's a big, you know, centennial issue, big, you know, long-standing character since issue one gets killed off, and that's the best cover you could come up with, like an untested thing. Whereas over in the X office, they were doing all sorts of cool stuff. Like, even as early as Fatal Attractions, you had those cool holograms, you know, those little box holograms on the cover that were really neat. So it's too bad that Spider-Man kind of shit the bed that way.
What a good way to end the episode. It's all together, Adam.
Oh, yes. Well, so next time we're going to be talking about Smoke and Mirrors, Players and Pawns, issue 400, and then probably Aftershocks. I'm not sure how much further we'll go than that, but those will be kind of the most natural spot. Now, Aftershocks, those two issues, the back matter in those issues was the Parker Legacy, I believe, which ended up being eventually repackaged as the Lost Year Zero, because you have JMD writing, you have John Romita Jr. on art, you have the creative team that will become the Lost Years team, and really it's what kind of starts that collaboration and eventually leads into the amazing Lost Years. So that'll be something we can talk about next episode. Really excited to talk about it because issue 400 is one of my favorite Spider-Man issues. JMD thinks it's one of his best works. A lot of people would agree, so I'm excited to talk about that. Excited to talk about Smoke and Mirrors and Naked Gwen Stacy for no reason, with just, you know,
super naked,
very specifically placed smoke and steam.
Smoke, yes,
oh my god, I love comics. It's so ridiculous. Doesn't make any sense, but I love it. So very excited about next episode. Any final thoughts on the Web of Life, Web of Death / Funeral for an Octopus?
They're learning how to do this multi-part, right? Like some Scarlet Spider stories, some Peter storylines, four issues here, four issues there. Overall, I think it's fine. I think they should have cut it down, but it's not a terrible volume that we're reading through. And I know it's going to get rough, maybe even more rough later on, but they're fine. Some of the ideas are good. They're doing, I think, as we repeated several times, they are doing a lot of these ideas earlier on than we, maybe our memory suggested to us, that like, oh, by the way, Peter's not who he seems he is, or who he thinks he is. So it's got some stuff in here that's good. If you want the best Spider-Man comics, don't start with this. That's the end of my report.
I don't think they ever explain why Peter is having memories of the cloning vat. Like, it's one of those things that's there, but like, they never address it. It never comes back. Like, it's just, he shouldn't be having those thoughts.
I mean, when they reveal that Peter is the clone, I mean, yeah.
But then why did Ben have those thoughts?
When they re-retcon it. Yeah, when they re-retcon it again, yeah, they needed a line where Norman was like, and by the way, I also gave you a little pill and it made you think that you were Ben. I don't know. But yeah, you're right. It is kind of just thrown out. If they hadn't done that additional retcon, it would have been fine. But yeah. Yeah.
But even then, the question would have been like, why are they both having that thought? But I mean, at the time, they're just trying to, you know, mysteries upon mysteries, you know?
I mean, if you really want to split a hair, he shouldn't have a perspective of himself outside of his body. It should be a first-person perspective of him, like, in a vat. But it's like him seeing himself, so it's not, yeah.
Very true.
And they're clearly, like, you know, when you look under the hood or you're reading it, like, now collected and in a different perspective and knowing the future, and it's hard to kind of... If you're for the first time, it might have a perspective, you never know. But it's kind of fun to kind of go back and see how, you know, what they're trying to accomplish. And you can tell that, you know, they're pivoting and making adjustments kind of on the fly as they go. So it's not going to be, you know, always the cleanest and best stories. But you can see the buildup. You can see where they're trying to go with certain things. You can see some of the foreshadowing they're starting to do. So there's definitely some fun and cool stuff in here that will, I mean, will pay off at the end of the day. But, you know, it is cool to kind of revisit a lot of these stories that we remember fondly, you know, in hindsight and back in the day. So I've been doing this whole book club and kind of seeing, like, some of the dialogue still kind of surprises me. I don't, you know, some of the quips and, you know, like that booty line that Ben does in that one book is kind of, oh, okay, sure.
It does make me feel like this was better served collecting issue to issue and, like, not always in order. like, at the time, I didn't have a ton, but I would get issues here and there.
Yeah.
And I would read something, and it was easier for me to kind of, like, because that was the issue I was reading. And it wasn't like, okay, I'm reading this in order to try to kind of comprehend this entirety, and we're going to talk about it. If I just read an issue, I can kind of turn my head aside and kind of ignore some of maybe the weird moments or the slightly more boring moments. But if all I have is an issue from the grocery store that my mom bought me because she was like, look, you know, you're being, you know, obnoxious. Here's an issue. Go read this somewhere else. And it's just about Kane running through the woods trying to find someone to kill. It's easy to forgive. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like letting your mind fill in the rest. Like if I read parts 1 and 4 of one of these, I'd be like, oh, okay, so the stuff that happened in the middle is probably this. Like it almost would be better in a way. Right? Than reading all of it, because there's just the stuff that's the slowdown, the stuff that feels like it's just kind of playing for time wouldn't be there in the same way. So it's almost like a disservice reading it in this format.
Interesting. Yeah,
there's definitely filler. I do agree that you look at both of these, and they could have both easily been 2 issues by, I guess, today's standards or whatever, right? So the padding is there, but I'm sure if we revisit other books of the time, that might have been very more commonplace than we realized.
Although if you're reading this, Paul, in the early 2000s, this would have been 12 issues. Oh, sorry. That's only if Bendis is writing it. Sorry, my bad.
Right.
Wow. Take that, Bendis. Jeez.
So, Paul, I'll mention it on podcast, but Nate and I were talking about something else before. So at our next episode, we'll continue the Clone Saga. We'll see Aunt May die. We'll see a lot of exciting, crazy stuff happen in the Aftershocks. That'll be the end of May for that episode. At the end of June, which will be, I guess, June 29th is when the episode will come out, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to read a few classic issues of Uncanny X-Men, specifically with Alpha Flight in them, which will come out just before Canada Day. So that'll be something a little bit different to jump into some X books that I don't think you've ever read. So we're talking about the first appearance of Weapon Omega originally, Nate, otherwise known as Guardian. So he shows up. You would have seen it in the X-Men animated series the Repo Man episode. So that'll be one thing that we're going to read. We're going to read the first full appearance of Alpha Flight and then another appearance not long after. So we're going to get into some, you know, late 70s, early 80s X-Men. And I don't think you've ever experienced this stuff. We're talking about John Byrne, X-Men Alpha Flight stuff. So I'm really excited to see what you think of it, Paul. And it's a perfect way for us to ring in Canada Day.
Wow. Are these an epics that Ben has or no?
Actually, yes. Yes, they are.
It's Weapon Alpha, I think.
Weapon Alpha, yes.
He's also a Heroclix. The rookie is Weapon Alpha. And Weapon Omega might be Kyle. Might be Kyle.
I think you're right.
Might be.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking.
Wild Heart or something?
Wild Heart and Wild. Do they ever go by Wild Thing? Wild Child.
Wild Child and AOA.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So, yeah, I believe Ben does have those, Paul, so you should be able to easily get a hold of those.
Yeah. So, we'll do a Alpha Flight thing. Hopefully you're happy about that. It seems like he made a little bit of a smile face.
I like Alpha Flight. Alpha Flight, yeah.
I don't know if he knew
what... Oh, wait, that's the other Alpha Flight.
No. This will be John Byrne. This will be good stuff.
Yeah, give me some Guardian, Vindicator, all that good stuff, Sasquatch, yeah.
Yeah. Later on, we can read about Murmur and Radius and stuff. Flex.
I would be all up for that. Like, I've barely read any of it, so I would actually be very interested. Although I do think Alpha Flight definitely is one of my blind spots. Like, I've read, I think, the first 24 issues, and I don't think I read anything after that. And then I read the Volume 2, which was the crazy kind of late 90s stuff. But yeah.
I cannot. You've heard me talk about this. Whenever they're doing new epic announcements, we're always saying, "Hey, you're like Nate. What do you want to hear? What do you want to see announced?" And it's Captain Britain for me and Alpha Flight. Like those are the two books that are, you know, X adjacent books that I really want them to reprint or print rather in epic format. So when they finally do, Paul had stepped away for a moment at it. So I'm going to say this: we should pick up a volume for him and get him an Alpha Flight epic. And we'll all do an epic volume read through together. He's back. He doesn't know what I said, so
he will,
he's never going to listen to this. So he doesn't know what this
is. Yeah, he'll never listen to this back. You're fine.
What did you say?
Nothing at all.
Never mind.
Oh.
I guess here's a question for you, Nate, before we sign off. Do you think they will announce a Spectacular Spider-Man epic line first, or that they'll announce an Alpha Flight epic line?
you know what? It's probably sad that it's going to be Alpha Flight before they do Spectacular, but they need to do Spectacular. Just get it announced, get it out there. It's Spider-Man, it's printing money. But I think that, yeah, that sadly it's going to be Alpha Flight first. Not sadly for me, but sadly for all the people who have been clamoring for years. It's weird.
It's crazy to think, though, isn't it?
Yeah, how many different Star Wars comics are out there and, like, being reprinted through Epics, all these different, like, branches of the Star Wars lineage, and they won't do another Spider-Man book. It's, I don't know. They must have a plan, and the plan is unknowable.
Unknowable. Well, that is a great spot for us to leave off. If you're still listening and still with us somehow, you can email us at comicshenanigans@gmail.com. Rate the show on Apple Podcasts. Listen to us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And thanks again for listening. Our next episode will be coming out in a week. We'll be having an interview with Pat Olive. And then a couple weeks later, we're going to have an interview with returning guest Ariana Marr. And so a lot of good stuff is in our future on the Comic Shenanigans podcast. So thanks again for listening, and we will catch you next time. Bye-bye.